See what I mean about I'm wanting to have a different approach to a marriage conference. What we're talking about here is your hearts. The job of a Christian psychologist is essentially to take what God tells us in Scripture and what we learn through our own experience and study and sort of operationalize that for us. What has God called us to? What does He want our hearts to look like? Our job is to figure out and understand the heart and then help explain that. Now, one of the things that's been kind of cool in doing therapy for 30 years is that I found that those things that help people grow the most or heal the most tend to be the things that God's been calling us to all along, right? No surprise there. So I want you to understand how your hearts work, all right? Let's keep going. Third eye, imperfection. This is a tough one. How do we make sense of how painful life is? You know, how do I make sense of how fallen I am? How I'm not what I wish I was? How do I make sense of how fallen my spouse is? They're not what I wish they were a lot, okay? This, by the way, is the only one of the four we're going to talk about that God did not create us to be able to learn. In other words, Adam and Eve in the garden would have had to learn about intimacy and grow there, and they would have had to learn about strength and identity and grow there, and they would have needed to learn to manage their emotional world, which obviously they managed poorly in that they ate that tree. But God did not create our hearts to navigate pain. That's why all of us struggle with it. We are fish out of water with this one. That's why all of us have trouble managing and metabolizing and making sense of hurt and shame. That's why all of us are insecure. All of us avoid pain at all costs. We're all born under the law, and we are broken. And we want it to be good again. We just want it to be the way we want it. And so much of our marriage problems is about our inability to manage the disappointment, the loss, the imperfection. And if you're waiting for your spouse to be perfect, bring a sack lunch. It's going to be a long wait, all right? So life is hard, marriage is hard, painful disappointment, and life will not work very well unless we have learned the ability, and it is ability we have to be taught, to deal with the fact, metabolize the fact, that everything on this planet that's not a Facebook post is a mess, okay? Your spouse is not everything that you dream, and we're not going to talk about what a carnival cruise it is to live with you, okay? So there's pain and sorrow. Now, we alluded earlier when we were talking about the blame marriage, we alluded how paradoxically a gigantic amount of marriage problems that we have are actually about the cockamamie ways in which we respond to the pain and disappointment and loss that we encounter in our relationship together, primarily by being jerks, by blamers, by protesters. I can't believe you, okay? In other words, we take one problem and turn it into two problems. I mean, now, once we're hurting, and now I'm being a jerk about it. You know, think happy thoughts, right? So for our spirituality to work, for our marriages to work, for life to work, we need to be taught and shown how to make sense of sorrow and loss and disappointment and stay grounded and keep our poise. Les just asked me to talk about that. I think I will in just a second. I might develop it a little bit more. So we have to have some pretty strong heart kung fu in order to do that. So two things again. We need two abilities. Can I forgive you? And can I forgive me? In other words, can I make sense of the fact that the world is fallen and make peace with that? And can I make sense of how I am fallen? Can I take in grace? Number one, forgiving them, our spouse, the world, forgiving them for the fallenness. Can I face the loss and the yuck and the pain and the disappointment that I encounter in my marriage and in my life and stay grounded? Let me put a face on this. I was telling you about my grandson. A while back, I hadn't seen him for a couple of weeks. And I told Norma, I said, I'm really missing Whit. And she said, well, good news. Tomorrow night, I'm keeping him at the house till about 6:30. And I'm like, cool. I'm off at 6. I'm going to race home and I'll get to see him. So I built my whole day around this. By lunchtime, I'm like, I'm going to run this thing like a railroad yard. I had clients in, out, dead on time. It's 10 till, sorry, we have to go. My office manager's going, there's a phone call. I'm like, tell him I'll call him back later. You know, I'm just like, boom, 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 boom. And I finally jump in the car after just busting myself all afternoon long because I'm staying on time because I know he's leaving the house at 6:30. I got to get home in the car all the way home. I'm losing time here. I get in the car. I call Norma. All right, I'm on my way. Here I come. And she goes, oh, I changed my mind. I decided to not keep him today. All right, you feel that? You feel it? All right? That's what marriage feels like. Right? So like I was talking to a group of singles once, and I said, wait, let me get this straight. You guys are unhappy because you're not married? All right, but think about it. Like, what do you want to say to her at that point? You feel what I mean with the protest? Are you kidding me? Do you not? Okay, I'm going to manage my pain by blessing her out. That's what our natural tendency is, okay? I always say this, and Norma does not like it, but it's true. The best of marriages are exercises in managing that kind of disappointment. Now, that's a story on her, a story on me. We were newlyweds. We were back from our honeymoon a week or two. We were living in a creaky little 1920s duplex in the Belhaven area of Jackson. We were upstairs getting ready for bed, and we hear this punk, crack sound downstairs. And we both look at each other. And Norma goes, what was that? And I'm like, I don't know. And she goes, well, it could be the boogeyman, somebody breaking in. And I'm like, yeah. And she goes, well, go check. And I'm like, you go check. And she... She goes, you're not going to go check? I'm like, no, it might be the boogeyman. Are you kidding me? And she goes, well, my daddy would have checked. And I'm like, let's call your daddy. Okay? That's what marriage feels like. All right? You with me? How about something darker? I saw a couple a while back. She got diagnosed with cancer. And it did this funny thing to their relationship. They started taking out their pain on one another. They were hurting and scared and terrified, and they started taking out that pain, being cruel and mean to each other. How do we make sense of pain and loss? This is an ability that we have to be taught, and it is a hard one to develop. What about a real betrayal, a way in which our spouses really hurt us? How do we grow there? This is a whole talk, and it's actually, I want to write a marriage book next, but the book after that is going to be a book on sadness. Because we don't take into account how important and how powerful and how healing sadness is. In order to grow here, we need to learn what it means to grieve. In order to grow here, we need to learn what it means to be sad. In order to grow here, we need to learn what it means to hold on to love in the context of pain and sorrow. I might lose this, this, or this, but I know I am loved. We need to learn what it means to have more of a sense of self. Who I am. This is painful, but it's not going to define me. This traffic jam doesn't define me. What does it say about me if I went off on Norma about the baby? How puny and weak am I? Can I be that strong that I can weather pain? There's enough of me there. So grieving and sadness, hanging on to love, making sense of that sense of strength. We can talk all about that in Q&A, but let me talk briefly about sadness. Sadness is a very misunderstood emotion, and it's fascinating. You can be depressed forever. You can be anxious forever. You can be angry forever. But if you feel sadness, you will transform. I call sadness a transitional emotion. It's a progressive emotion. And I think it's a gift from God. It's a very unusual thing. My currency, my life is in the world of emotion, and sadness is unique. People say, he's sad and depressed. No, if you're sad, you won't get depressed. Because if you're sad, your heart will start to heal and metabolize your pain. If I can be sad that I didn't get to see my baby, I'm not going to be mean to Norma. If I engage real loss and feel real genuine sadness, somehow it softens it. And I do not know how that works. And it is my job. I think it's a God thing. I told you about my brother's death 30 years ago. Now, if it 30 years ago and I was telling you about it, I'd start crying. I didn't cry tonight when I talked about him. Why? Do I love him less? Do I miss him less? No, sadness and grief has done its work and turned that sharp, toxic loss into something softer, something that almost feels loving when I think about it. The tears I feel when I think about him now are not that ripping of his death. They're the love of missing him and knowing that right now he loves me. I don't know how sadness works, but the title of my book is going to be "There's Just Not Enough Sadness in This World." Catchy, right? Okay. We can talk more about that if you want. It is a huge issue. If most pathology is an attempt to not be sad. Depression is a way to block sadness. Anxiety is a way to not feel sad. Oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Well, what if we just felt sad? I'm not going to get what I wanted. Of course, substance abuse, ways to not feel our loss. Usually when I can get my clients to start feeling sad, they stop being depressed and stop being anxious, and they start feeling genuinely what is true, that we are limited, small humans under God's care, and things are going to hurt, and we're going to walk through that together, my friends. Sadness together. If you were sad, it would change how much you sin, because we take and sin rather than being sad that I can't have that. If Adam and Eve had been sad, we wouldn't be sitting here today. They would have said, oh, that tree is so delightful to the eyes and profitable to make one wise. I want that. So sad that I can't have it. Of course, we can have every other tree in the garden, but this is really sad. And we wouldn't be sitting here. The best of us was called a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. Psalm 85, he who goes forth sowing seeds of sorrow comes back leaping with sheaves of joy. The Bible is always talking about this theme of mourning leading to resolution and sadness. That's not just some spiritual principle. It is a psychological fact. Okay? So, we turn the marriage conference into a sad conference. You learn sadness and you'll be happy. All right. Can I forgive myself? Can I take in grace? This is for people who live in the perfectionistic, guilty rat race, or the Christian have to be good all the time rat race. People who can't have anyone over their house without decorating it like a garden and gun photo shoot. Or, they live at the whim of disappointing people. Oh my gosh, we could never say that. I could never say that to them, you know, because they'd feel too scared and too guilty. These are people who don't want you to really know them because they feel like they're kind of badder than everybody else, you know. So this question is, what do I do with my own fallenness and imperfection? Okay, you know, the old Seinfeld joke, the number one phobia in the world is public speaking. Okay, why is that? Because you could look like an idiot up here, right? He then goes on to say the second number two phobia is death, which means technically, given any funeral, most people would rather be in the casket than given the eulogy. All right. So anyway, I already know I'm an idiot, so I don't feel much shame standing in front of people. But have we developed the ability to feel forgiven, to take in grace? Now, as you're picking up, the only place that we develop these abilities that are missing is in the context of relationship. You can learn stuff in your head with books and conferences and stuff like that, but where do you learn stuff in your gut? You know, people say to me, and this is actually the question that got me into psychology in the first place, you know that weird feeling where I can know that I'm forgiven, but I don't feel forgiven? I know God's in control, but I still feel anxious. You guys have that? You got a regular crowd here? Okay. That question got me into psychology. Like, why is it I can know that I'm forgiven, but I still feel guilty and like God's mad at me? What's the deal with that? I call that the head-heart gap. And I have people all the time tell me, I know I'm forgiven, but I don't feel forgiven. How do you address that? Well, what I ask them is, have you ever hurt somebody or let somebody down or really shown somebody your junk? And you look in their eyes, and their eyes don't fall. Their eyes look back at you and go, yeah, you did hurt me, but you know what? I forgive you. And yeah, you're a mess, and I am too. I'm not the same kind of mess, but I'm just as big a mess. Welcome to the club. Have you ever had anybody do that? And those people always go, no way, man. I mean, when we were growing up, if you messed up, Dad became Mussolini, and you know, you learned your lesson quick, okay? In other words, the only way we ever develop a capacity like that is by experiencing it in relationships. Now, where are we going to get those relationships? Look around you. We're going to talk about that, okay? So, we learn to forgive me, make room for me to disappoint you or let you down. We learn that by experiencing grace in relationships and bringing that back to our marriage. Only then, we're going to get back to you doormats here for a second. Only then is there room for me to let myself disappoint others or let them down or not be exactly what they wanted and not freak out or to see that I've made my spouse angry and I don't panic and I don't try to make it all better, you know? You know the saying, if mama ain't happy, then ain't nobody happy? I vote we just let mama be unhappy some, you know? It'll help her grow, frankly, you know? Instead of dance monkey dance all the time. Otherwise, if you don't do that, if you're always trying to keep mama happy, whatever, or daddy happy, or sister happy, whoever it is, you will start living as a slave. And there are people in your life who'll be just fine with that. But you run that forward in marriages, and you have that spouse who's always trying to please the other spouse and live the other spouse's life and do this stuff to keep them from being unhappy all the time. You run that forward and you see those super good selfless types ultimately break and say, I am sick of being little Miss Good, and they get depressed or they leave or they have affairs. And people go, oh my gosh, what's happening in marriages nowadays? Well, one of the things that's happening in marriages nowadays is perhaps that little Miss Complier 25 years ago didn't say, you know, I'm sorry you're having a tantrum, but I'm getting out of your blast radius, and my answer's still no, okay? That's killing marriages too, all right? So you getting this? Having these abilities is what makes marriage work. Lacking these abilities, and it's hasta lasagna, don't get any on you, okay? We're not just learning communication skills here, all right? Now, if I didn't manage to get you with the first three, which I doubt, if there's still some of you out there going, yep, check, got all that, I'm the good one, she's a screwed up one, okay? I'm going to get you on this one, okay? This one's the Cuban baby. This is the Cohiba. This is the Monte Cristo, because nobody can do this one. And I'm going to stretch you here a little bit. But this is the secret of the universe, making sense of impulse control and emotional management. Notice these get more complex as we're going because they're developmental. Notice a parenting expert wrote this talk. Children, infants are learning intimacy. Toddlers are learning identity. School-aged kids are making sense of imperfection. Teenagers to 59-year-olds are making sense of impulse control. But here's the bottom line. If you want to understand why we humans do the stuff we do, you got to understand the amount of power that emotion has over humans. And once you start paying attention, you will realize how many of our choices and how much of our life and how much of our culture and how much in our marriages we are driven by emotional reactivity. Okay? Think about it. Culturally. The stock market, economic indicators, my hind leg. It's emotionally driven. It's fear and greed. Oh my gosh, I'm scared we're losing money. Sell. Oh my gosh, everybody's making money. Buy. Whatever. Okay? At least they had the integrity to call it market sentiment. I'm like, well, thank you for that at least. This is all about sentiment, okay? Our current political climate, whether people are marching in the streets or walking out on the speaker or Trump's latest tweet, whichever side of the political agenda, we're about 13 years old culturally, okay? Our culture is junior high, all right? And for us individually, why can't you stay on a diet? It's emotion. You're committed. I'm going to do it this time. But then you go to Proud Larry's with your friends, and they're all getting burgers and beer and fries, and you're like, is there like a grilled chicken salad on this thing? But you're smelling the onion rings, man, and then what starts to happen? You start feeling a feeling, deprivation, loss. Oh man, that burger smells so good. I can't stand the feeling of depriving myself of that. So what do? You cheat on your diet. Why? Because you can't manage the emotion. Our lives are run by it. And obviously, this is a big deal in marriages. Here's the question. Can I have an emotion? Can I feel something and not need to react? So part one, can I think as opposed to just react? And can I let you in? Like we said earlier, can I let emotions be part of our relationship? So again, two questions. Can I think and not just react? Can I feel and not be Mr. Spock? Okay. All right. Let's look at can I think first. It goes like this. We begin our lives as children, right? Going too fast for you? Now, children are concrete thinkers, and children are concrete feelers. In other words, for children, emotions are real things. In other words, they do what they feel because they're concrete, right? So if you don't buy that four-year-old the bubblicious at the checkout counter, he doesn't say, "Mom, that makes me so sad and disappointed. I have so many sad feelings about that." No, what does he do? He does his feelings, all right? Now, what about the executive going off at the Delta gate agent because the flight delays? Exactly the same guy. He's still 4 years old emotionally, okay? He's doing his feelings. You push a kid down the playground, he's either going to hit you back or run away. They do their feelings. Now, somewhere between then and adulthood, we develop the ability to where some guy can cut you off on the interstate and you go, "Ugh, idiot, I'd like to run into the back of that guy and teach him a lesson." But you don't. Hopefully. Now, what happened in those intervening years? Well, God made us to where, in order to do relationships well and life well and to serve him well and to do obedience well and to do marriage well, we need to be taught the ability, learn the software to be able to have emotions and look at them and think about them and not necessarily let them run our behavior. Or as we used to say to our kids, you can be angry at your sister, you can't hit her. Or as God says, you can be angry but sin not. Same kind of thing, okay? Now, as you can imagine, this is a huge dynamic in your marriage. You're driving along and your wife says, honey, just turn right up here. And we go, "Look, I know how to drive," okay? And she's like, "Whoa, you know, sun's going down, big guy. Sun's going down," all right? But what just happened? What just happened? Well, if you're like most men, what happened is you had a feeling that is implied by her assistance, a feeling that says, "Listen, she thinks you're so stupid, you can't even get to church on your own. She's got to tell you, are you that stupid?" You know, we're like, "No, our forefathers crossed the Alleghenies. You don't need to tell me how to get to church," you know. Now, what's driving that? Your emotional reactivity. Instead of thinking, "Wow, that really triggers something, my pride, something," okay, we just react. So Norm and I are watching the U.S. Open like this summer, and you know the camera's panning the crowd, and there's Meghan Markle, and she goes, "Oh, John, that's Meghan Markle. She married Prince Harry, and she's the Duchess of Sussex." And I said, "Well, that is so helpful, Norma. Since I've been off-world for the last several years, and my ship has just now returned to Earth, I didn't know who Meghan Markle was." All right. Now, why was I at jerk? Because I felt insulted. Like, "You don't think I know who Meghan Markle is?" Okay? That's my maturity level here, gang. Remember? I told you I'm as big a knucklehead as you guys, okay? In other words, Kim, I learned to catch the fact that I am feeling a feeling and try to learn to decide what to do with it rather than just reacting. I tell couples all the time that marriage interactions should be golf, not tennis. Okay? Basically, what usually happens in our marriage is our spouse says something to us or does something, and we're just like, top spin forehand back at you. All right? No. It's not tennis. It's golf. They say something snarky or something that hurts your feelings. Slow it down. Check out the ball. See how the green breaks. This is golf. Okay, unfortunately, they're not going anywhere. You got plenty of time, all right? So I want you to take a look, you know, figure out how to plan your shot. Think. We're going to talk about this in the conflict talk tomorrow, that if you live out of your little reptile brain back here, you're going to wreck your marriage. We need to learn to think. Frontal lobes, people, okay? I want this to be golf. I want you to be cool, okay? Like two little Fonzies. And what's Fonzie like? He's cool. Correcto mundo. Check out the big brain on Brett. Movie reference. Who knows what I'm talking about? Pulp Fiction, good, yeah. What's Fonzie like? So can I say, you know, I'm kind of scared and angry about how you're spending money. It's kind of becoming a problem for me. Can I tell you what I'm feeling? Or do I go, oh my gosh, you think I made of money? Or can I say, it kind of hurt me that you didn't defend me with your parents. That hurt. I'm telling you a feeling. What we usually say is, well, why don't you just go live with your mommy? You love her so much. Okay, you feel the difference? We'll talk about this one under the intimacy talk tomorrow. The difference between having a feeling and doing a feeling, okay? So can I think? Other side of this is, can I feel? And this is tied into the can I let you in piece, and we're going to talk more about it tomorrow. So just skimmy. A lot of people don't bring their emotions to the relationship at all. They're John Wayne, Mr. Spock, whatever, and that's cool, you know, the lone gunslinger type and all that. But as we said, the problem with that is you live your life without your heart connected to somebody else. And not only is that lonely, it's often the fruit of symptoms. We're talking about intimacy, and we'll talk about intimacy tomorrow as it relates to marriage, but unconnected parts of your soul get worse. Disconnected parts of us don't get better. One of the reasons therapy works is because if you bring a human into a relationship with another human, they get better. Okay? So that disconnection, don't bring your feelings into the relationship, actually hurts your soul, not just your marriage. Okay? But we can grow there. Actually, I had this couple once, and the guy was just like, you know, Mr. Spock, total logical. He was an accountant and, like, didn't have an emotional bone in his body. But he learned to recognize that that was true about him. He knew that he was really kind of clueless emotionally. And he really got to work and started trying to learn in the therapy. And his wife was learning to kind of back off and slow down with her flood of emotion, okay? But one day he comes to session and he says, I got a little card for my wife and I wanted to bring it here to therapy to give it to her. Because he had kind of learned to laugh at himself and his own tendency. And he hands her the card and the card says, this is just a little note to let you know how I feel. You open it up and it says, I feel fine. Okay? So anyway, don't do that, all right? All right, we're done. Those are the basic building blocks of relationship, okay? And as you can see, they so parallel the image of God. We're talking about love, we're talking about stewardship and steadfastness and faithfulness, we're talking about forgiveness, we're talking about humility, we're talking about obedience in the face of what I want to take and do for myself. And life works well to the degree that we have these, and relationships work well to the degree that we have these, and we serve God well to the degree that we have these, and not having them will mess up your marriage, okay? Now, what I want you to do is to learn to use these to diagnose your marriage. I mean, as you look at this list, you may see one or two in which you have a little bit of trouble. The advanced students see four in which you have a little bit of trouble, okay? Either way, you're normal. Now, bring those to your marriage, and you can see my point tonight is that you don't have a bad marriage. Basically, you're both just missing some pieces, okay? So let's start growing together like friends. I don't care how much a team works. If the players are lousy athletes, you ain't going anywhere, okay? So I want you to start using this to catalog your blind spots. Instead of just fighting, I want you to be thinking, could this be one of my blind spots? I want you to ask your friends. I want you to ask the people you trust, where do you think I might be missing? They'll be able to tell you quick. This is a great topic for date night. I want you to say, you know, that whole forgive myself thing, I can't do that at all. That's why I'm like a maniac when you point out my flaws, because I get all the shame. I want you talking about this, okay? But mostly I want you leaving here as friends, not enemies. wow, we struggle because we're both incomplete, not we struggle because you're so annoying, okay? I want you to have that orientation in marriage, because if you've been paying attention, you've heard something in the background of all of this. One last ability that supersedes every other one, whether we're talking about marriage or talking about faith, and that is the ability to live in a position of humility and repentance. You've heard me imply it over and over again. In other words, can I live in that place that says, oh my gosh, I'm broken and I'm a mess and I need help? I'm as big a part of our problem as you are. Get out of that who's the bad guy position. Stop living like, thank you, Lord, that I am not as other men, namely my husband. Okay? Just like this is the beginning point of our faith, it is the beginning point of marriage. Think about it. We all run to the altar to be Christians. Oh, yes, Lord, I'm a sinner. I am so bad. And then we get married, and suddenly it's like, no way, I'm not the bad guy. You know, what happened? I thought you were the bad guy. Isn't that the point of the gospel? I want it to be the point of your marriage. We're both incomplete, screwed up people. Let's quit being enemies about it. And I do talks like this to singles, and they'll go, great, where am I supposed to find somebody who has all these amazing character abilities? And I'm like, well, point taken. There's only one, and he sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty, okay? But otherwise, find somebody who just has one. This one. That he's humble and repentant. And maybe he's a Neanderthal emotionally, but he knows he's a Neanderthal emotionally, okay? Marry that Neanderthal, okay? That guy can grow, okay? So if you can do humble, man, we can take you to school. We can talk all y'all want about what it looks like to be growing here in this place. But if you're not humble and repentant, if you're not willing to say, I'm part of this problem and I want to grow and learn how this applies to me, then you're going to be kind of stuck. And enjoy that position. Jesus said that's your reward in full. It's not a good place. Trust me, okay? Now, let me just throw out some pointers about growth, because we keep implying it. And I'll talk about it all you want in Q&A. But growth takes place in relationship. This kind of growth. That's why therapy was invented. But why was therapy invented about the same time as the automobile? Well, because around the time of the Industrial Revolution, our culture fragmented and we're no longer living in community. God created us to live and grow and develop these kind of incomplete parts of us with one another. But our culture totally doesn't do this anymore. So we invent things like therapy and small groups and whatever. But why are there so many each others in the New Testament? Because what God is telling us and what Paul is calling us to is to start to recognize that the way we live with one another in individual friendships or in informal small groups or formal small groups is the matrix for where we do grow in these things. And I like to challenge churches to be thinking, how can our church be a place where we start being able to say, my prayer request isn't that Aunt Betty has a gallbladder attack. My prayer request is, I've learned that you four guys who I've been meeting with for a while, you guys are safe and you're going to show me grace and you're going to tell me the truth and you're not going to go home and tell your wives. I can tell you, you're my wife. No, you can't. Okay? And I'm going to say my prayer request is, I really struggle with my anger, guys. And I don't know what to do about it. And you start bringing stuff like that into safe relationships, people grow, churches change. And I go to churches all over the country, and I see churches doing this, and it's transforming people. They're growing like weeds. We can talk more about what that looks like. But all therapy is a systematized, strategic form of the fellowship that God's called us to. It's why fellowship is one of the means of grace, for crying out loud. Right up there with scripture and prayer and sacraments and worship. Fellowship. What that means is us touching one another's lives. Now, it'll take a while for us to learn that because it's not according to our culture anymore. But I want to at least open that door. We can look at that whole area of growth there, right? Now, thus endeth the lesson. Let's do some questions. Do you have the mic? Yeah, good. Handheld questions first. If not, I'll look on my phone and see if there's anything.
I'll be over here. JD will be over there. I think.
Let's see if anybody's texted me. can't remember what the Google app looks like.
Got a question.
A real person.
A real person. So I'm a professor, teacher, and one of the things that's very common in the teaching profession is when you have quirks and idiosyncrasies, you usually have no idea.
Yeah.
And it's not until you get filmed and you watch yourself that you're just like, I can't believe what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I have that experience.
Yeah. So how does one go about recognizing things in yourself that you just don't see?
Great question. And a total piggyback on what I was just saying. Humans are uniquely, profoundly, and astonishingly blind. We don't see ourselves at all. And basic principle of the universe is we need other people's eyes to help us see ourselves. Okay? In other words, what the church is supposed to be is a community that is safe enough to where I can tell you the truth about you. And I'm going to tell you the truth about you knowing the truth about me. And I'm going to tell you the truth about you in a humble way. And I want you to even be proactive about that. I want you to learn to live with one another. And maybe just start with your best friend. Like one of the guys I practice with, he and I are super good pals, and we'll have lunch, and it'll be like, I need your help today. And we take turns being the one who's the giver and who's the receiver. But I want to say to my friends, kind of like David, search me and know me. I want to be open and receptive. I was talking to a friend of mine today about a conflict I had with my publisher. And I said, man, he just kind of let me have it. And he had all this anger. And my friend said, yeah, but you know what? I talked to you right after that happened, and you were pretty ramped up, man. And I said, really? And they said, yeah. I mean, maybe he was angry, but it felt like you were bringing a lot to the table too. And I said, I totally wasn't aware of that, like your video, okay? Other people's eyes are our best friend. I call it people who will stab you in the front. Find those people. They are treasures. Wounds of a friend, kisses of an enemy. Get it? Okay? Somebody else to point out your destructiveness, hurtfulness, brokenness in a kind way. My coworker, who's a good mentor person with me, somebody approached him one day. This guy's a real super hardcore theological judgmental guy. And he approaches my friend and he goes, so-and-so doesn't really hang out with me anymore. I call him for lunch. He kind of blows me off. And my business partner guy says to him, well, it's because he thinks you're judgmental. And he's afraid that you're going to judge him because you can kind of come across like that. I'm like, what a gift he gave him, right? So I would ask. I would look for those people. Other people's eyes are the only hope we have there. The Bible presupposes, you're thinking about growing in your marriage. The Bible presupposes you are in community growing. The Bible has a lot more to say about oneness in the body than it has about oneness in marriage. It has a lot more to say about love one another, rebuke one another, comfort one another, support one another, challenge one another, forgive one another in the body than it does in marriage. Marriage should be the fruit of that kind of growth, not the resource for it.
So we've never had an argument, but if we do ever, if we have one, is there a particular of these abilities that you find that is the first place to go to check in to figure out either how you got there or the best way to kind of get through that argument? Are they tied in together? Just kind of.
Are you going to be here tomorrow?
All
right, we're going to do a whole session on conflict. Help me understand your question a little bit better so I can take a stab at it. When you're in a conflict, are there particular aspects of this that...
Is there one over the other of those four in particular?
Well, of course, every one of them can create conflict.
Right.
In other words, you know, we make intimacy sound real sweet. I mean, I talk about y'all need to develop more intimacy. Doesn't that sound sweet? Like you're like holding hands over, you know, at a two-top. Oh, hey, baby, you know. But this is an intimate statement. You really hurt me last night. That's intimacy, man. That's really my heart. So bringing my real heart is going to create some gravel, all right? Me be me and you be you. Obviously, we're going to disagree. One of the things we'll talk about tomorrow is Most conflicts start with a problem, which is how two people make sense of not being the same person. Now, can I make room for you to matter and me to matter too? Most people don't. Most every couple turns a disagreement into a win-lose. In other words, you want to add on the house and I don't. Which one of us is going to win? Now, when people smell that, it's like sharks smelling blood. I get scared and I'm going to fight you because I'm not going to get thrown under the bus, okay? Imperfection, obviously, is a big source of creating conflict because of what I said about protest. In other words, our natural go-to as humans when we are disappointed or sad or Norma forgets to bring the, no, changes her mind to bring the grandbaby, our natural go-to is to be angry and mean about it and presto, you have a fight. Anyway, so any of them can create it. In terms of getting out of it, I'm going to save those goodies for tomorrow about what sort of tools we can use to actually back ourselves out of that grenade as it started to explode, all right? Yes, sir.
Hey, John.
I like that the dudes are asking questions. How about that?
How would you define narcissism, and also what are some of the traits that you've seen in your practice?
Huh. Well, first let me make a distinction between formally a narcissistic personality disorder and a narcissistic style. There are a few people who have a narcissistic personality disorder, and that is they live with this chronic position of grandiosity. Their life is defined by I'm better than you. They only want to be superior and make you inferior, and that's kind of a defining theme in their lives. It's rare to run across somebody who's that pure, okay? But you run across people with a narcissistic personality style all the time. Now, let me tell you how narcissistic personality style works. Basically, if you go here to imperfection, and what you learn is that your own badness, your own smallness, your own weakness is humiliating, is weak, is going to cause people to pull away from you. You have this part inside of you that feels like being small, being less than ideal is terrible. So someone who lives with a narcissistic personality style says, well, then I'm never going to be terrible. I'm going to be awesome. I'm going to impress everybody. I'm going to do all I can to please people and look cool and be 10 feet tall, good looking, and bulletproof, right? And that's going to be my orientation. Now, the reason that people live that way is because if they don't live that way, they feel a ton of shame. In other words, we will choose a narcissistic personality style because I'm afraid if you see my weakness, you will shame me. And so we live oriented toward, no, I didn't, because I have to stay good, all right? Now, it's just a natural accidental byproduct of that. It usually needs to make other people feel bad. I'm the right one, you're the wrong one. So a narcissistic personality style, they're unpleasant to be around because they think they're just amazing and you feel kind of crummy around them. In other words, that's one of the ways I often diagnose them in my office. If I'm with somebody and I start feeling kind of bad about myself, like, oh, I wish I was as cool as him, I'm like, ah, he's making me feel that. That's his deal, okay? So basically, all of us, in a sense, have a narcissistic personality disorder because we were born under the law. We have a core sense inside that being bad is dangerous and scary and we're under condemnation and we try to want to look good all the time. So in a sense, it's a pretty broad definition. But you get the dance. Yeah, okay, good. Now throw that in a marriage, BT dubs, and that narcissistic personality style better be married to an individual who's strong enough to push back on it. Because a narcissist is going to come in and go, what were you thinking saying that at that party? And they're going to talk down to them. Now, if that person doesn't say, woo, like who lit a fire under you? I don't think I want to have a conversation that starts like that and come up here. If they stay down here and go, well, I thought you said it was, if they stay there, they will live there forever. Okay, that's where that limit setting on a jerky person has to happen, or that marriage will deconstruct. Love is as important as limits to make a marriage work. Lay it on me.
So how does one learn to be sad? Asking for a friend.
You know where I would start? I want to start with having people in my life who help me learn to get better at being aware of what I feel. Okay, so I walk out there and nobody's bought a single one of my books. What am I going to feel about that? Now, if you love me and you're my friend, you're going to go, John, what was that like? And I'm going to have to go in emotionally and go, what was that like? Well, it kind of felt embarrassing. And I think I felt really sad. I was hoping people would buy it. Okay, you helped me get in touch with the fact that I was sad. All right? So if you leave yourself alone, if you don't monkey with your heart, you will feel sad normally. Grief is like asking how do I grieve is kind of like asking how do I make water go downhill. It's going to go downhill unless something's in its way. And so when people are trying to grieve a death, for instance, and they have a problem with that, my question is, I start looking for what is keeping them from feeling what is true. And so if you want to start asking the question of how do I feel sadness, I want to start asking, what do you do with your emotions? Can you feel joy? Can you feel love? Can you feel embarrassment or hurt? And if you have people you can feel with, what you'll find is that sadness is right there. We just run from it real quick. Okay, so instead of feeling sad that nobody buys my book, I'm going to feel angry and stupid. Now, if I slow down, what I really feel is sad, right? That's a start on an answer. Can you help me anymore? Anybody else got any thoughts on that? You're my body of Christ. How do you think we get sad? Give me a little help. All right, giving yourself permission. What part of us might need permission? What's that part saying that says you can't? I got to run away because this hurts? Okay, we don't want to hurt. See, there's a lot more to this that I should get to. Nobody wants to hurt. Sadness is kind of like giving up. Sadness is sort of like admitting that you're small. Sadness is sort of like saying, I can't win this one. Sadness is getting into our place of humility. You know, why does Paul tell us to rejoice in trials? What's the deal with that? Well, the reason is because we all want to live 10 feet tall, good looking, and bulletproof. We don't want to live in the reality that we're small and contingent. We want to be Laodiceans. We want to say, I'm rich and powerful and have need of nothing. And Jesus says, no, you're small and poor and blind and pitiful and naked. Come to me. Now, if you're like me, you don't want to live that way. I don't like feeling small. But it's the truth. And it's the only thing that drives us to God. And everything in the fall and everything in my human fallen nature wants to run away from being vulnerable or needful or weak. I want to know exactly the answer for his question. I don't like needing to ask y'all for help. I want to be smarter than that. But trials and things that we can't do force us to start seeing our true state, that I am actually small and need. And in that sense, it's the greatest gift in the whole world. What would you give to have something that would take you out of your self-delusion and show you the truth about your heart before God? What would you give for that? Would you rejoice in that? You know that scene in Raising Arizona where they're stealing the balloons and he goes, these balloons blow up in funny shapes? And the guy says, no, not less than you think. Round's funny. Well, are trials something to rejoice in? No, not less than you think. Really seeing who you are before God is worth rejoicing in. So we don't want to face the truth, and sadness puts us in a place that's small. So we got to ask that question too. One of the things I talk about in my book is being a good enough parent. That was a good enough answer.
Can I ask you something real quick?
All right, it's peg straight up eight. You leaders tell me what you need to do. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, on the intimacy, the second question, I think I understand, can I let you in? The can I keep you in is that, am I willing to stay engaged and be vulnerable? Or what? I couldn't remember exactly what you were saying.
All right, we're going to blow that one up tomorrow on intimacy too, but let me tell you. What you expect to hear in a marriage conference is, intimacy means you guys just need to share more together. You know, you need to open your hearts and be more connected and learn to be more intimate. Okay, and that's exactly one half of the story. The other half of the story is those people who live in a position of a little bit of insecurity. In other words, I'm going to tell you tomorrow about a guy I worked with, and he's really kind of insecure and needing reassurance and needing his wife to tell him that she loves him, and he needs her to be affirming him all the time. And if she doesn't, he can't keep love in, so he's always needing the reassurance. And if she's quiet, he's like, is anything wrong? Okay. In other words, he doesn't have that granted security of keeping love in. And he'll say things to her like, hey, I love you. Which she hears exactly like you just did. Okay, not as a declaration of this man's love, but as a needy little like, you love me back? And she'll go, yeah, love you too, which really doesn't scratch his itch, okay? And so they get off to the races, all right? So his question is, can I keep love in? And that is, can I live grounded in my own sense of self, my own trust that you love me, that's not gone away just because you're in a bad mood or watching the game? And we'll talk tomorrow about how those two people marry each other and just chase each other's tails around the room. Because she's like wanting more intimacy, which makes him feel more criticized, which makes him pull away. And now she has even less intimacy to the old folks home.
So back, I want to talk back about the sadness.
Yes.
So I think a lot of times it's not just that we are not ready to accept that we're sad, but also other people are not allowing us to be sad.
Oh, bingo, good one, go. Preach.
So even our spouses, so, you know, Bible band-aiding, stuff like that.
Yeah.
People don't want us to hurt, but
right.
Sometimes we need to be hurt. And yeah. So what would you say to someone who's dealing with a spouse who supposedly is always like, oh, you know, how can I fix it? Blah, blah, blah.
Right. Well, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but we're going to talk about that tomorrow, too. Tomorrow's going to be a big day, all right? Let me go back to what you're saying. One of the things we're going to say tomorrow is there's three places we can be in regard to someone else's pain. We're going to call it blow them off, fix it, or learn what it means to be with other people. Now, blow off means like, oh my gosh, you know, it could be worse. Fix is like, you know, all things work together for good. Or, we have a rule in Jackson that if your grief season lasts more than 6 months, people start going, I think she's really not doing very good. You know, like you've got this time limit. Other people's sadness makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And so it is their emotional need that is driving them to need to fix it. Okay? So if I'm wanting to share a feeling and someone starts to fix it, what I might say to them is, I know that you really want to help me with this. What I really would like to ask is if you would manage whatever need it is you are having right now to make me feel better and just be with me in it. Remember, I'm the emotionally oriented one in my marriage and my wife's more practical. I will even preface comments like that. I'll say, I want to tell you about something that happened today and I don't need you to fix it or do anything about it. I just want you to like hear me and be with me in it. Okay, I've already kind of laid out my fertilizer, all right? So instead of her fixing it and me getting mad, I'm taking a little responsibility for it. But yes, our culture hates sadness. That's one of the reasons our culture gets crazier and crazier, because most pathology is an attempt to not feel sad. And when you feel sad, you're on the way, but you're mopping up, man, because you'll be healing. That transitional emotion will take you to heaven on a white horse. Okay? Good point. Thank you.